and welcome to the Money Talk podcast. I'm Ed Monk. Today on the show, will the investment story in China have a happy ending? The case for China has been clear for years, if not decades, but investors there have been made to wait for the spoils to arrive. We'll assess the prospects for China now, and then a look at Google, that most thoroughbred of tech phenomenon companies, as it grows to become the fourth $1 trillion company. If you enjoy the show, please rate us, share us, or leave a comment wherever you get your podcasts. China's economic rise means its companies now have an aggregate value of $8 trillion, and that's not counting the many firms with Chinese origins listed in overseas markets. Its GDP growth remains above 6%, and its giant affluent middle class continues to expand. So why have investors in China found it so hard to make any money? To help answer that, I'm joined by Tom Stevenson, investment director here at Fidelity. Tom, it's Chinese New Year on Saturday. It's the year of the rat. But for investors, it may feel a bit more like Groundhog Day. You've been looking at returns from China this week. What did you find out?
Well, over the short term, well, short to medium term, I'm talking about the last 2 years, they've broadly gone nowhere, but they haven't gone nowhere in a flat line. 2018 was a really bad year for the Chinese stock market, fell by about 30%. 2019 clawed back all of that loss. So really very strong, particularly at the beginning part of the year, the first 3 months of last year was very strong. So it's a volatile market, and I think that's quite important. We might come back to that. If you look on the longer term, it's also not been great, actually. If you look at what's happened in the US market over 10 years, the S&P 500 has essentially tripled over that period. The equivalent for the Chinese benchmark, the CSI 300, which is a measure of shares in Shanghai and Shenzhen, is up by about 20% over that period. So you're right, it has been quite difficult for investors to make money in China, despite the apparent strength of the Chinese economy over that time.
Yeah, because I mentioned that the GDP growth remains at 6%. We're used to this sort of mantra that in the very long term, stock markets are going to mirror what growth in the wider economy is doing, and that makes lots of sense. So, you know, why is it that that growth isn't translating into stock market gains?
I think there are a number of reasons for that. I think there's a sort of inherent suspicion about the Chinese economy and the Chinese stock market. So, you know, first of all, with the Chinese economy, I think there's this persistent belief that you can't really trust the figures. It's a bit of an illusion. It's built on a bed of shaky foundations of high debt levels, and the worry is that, you know, it could all go wrong in the future. And I think that's reflected a bit in the rating, the valuations which investors are prepared to apply to the Chinese stock market. And within the stock market itself, I think there are other problems such as, you know, it's a relatively closed market. It is beginning to open up, but it has been a closed market. It's been quite difficult for global investment dollars to find opportunities in China because of the capital constraints in that market.
Yeah, and obviously it's been on the front line of trade dispute with the US, but the sort of pain of that trade dispute doesn't seem to be equally shared in terms of the stock markets. It seems to be China that's always bearing the brunt when the market fears that trade concerns are gonna stymie growth.
Yes, I think that's partly true. Although I think, and we're talking about China, we're not talking about America here. But if you look at the American stock market and you strip out the technology stocks which have really driven the performance of that market, I suspect that the performance of the rest of the market doesn't actually look that good. And there will be pockets of manufacturing industry, for example, in America, which have suffered because of the trade wars.
Yeah. Now, by coincidence, I suppose we're recording today on the news of, worryingly, further deaths as a result of a coronavirus outbreak in China. This echoes a little bit the SARS pandemic from 2003. You mentioned there about the market's reaction to any sort of negative news or bad news from China. Is this actually an example of that? It's serious and it's worrying. I think there's been in the region of 300 cases of this confirmed. But is it fair for the market to assume, you know, a big negative economic hit? Maybe travel's going to be restricted a bit, but there's no reason to think that this is a sort of game changer, yet the market has reacted in quite an extreme way.
It has, and the fact of the matter is we simply don't know. So investors will tend to assume the worst initially. So, you know, I'm not surprised that the markets in both China and Hong Kong have fallen. If this does spread to Hong Kong, obviously Hong Kong is a much more sort of intense, closed city. So something like that could spread very, very rapidly in a way that it probably won't in China. But I think it comes back to the previous point I was making about this sort of underlying suspicion about China. And for me, it probably represents something of an opportunity because, I mean, we talked about the performance of the US market and the Chinese market. The consequence of that underperformance over time is that the Chinese market is really very cheap compared to the US market, and you know history tells us that you know you should invest in out of favor markets. That's where the opportunity lies, not in investing at the top of the market. So you know if you look at the fundamentals of the Chinese economy, it accounts for probably accounted for twice the contribution to global growth over the last 10 years that the US market did. So it's a very, very significant part of the global economy. There's some very interesting companies there, particularly in the technology field. I think the consumer story there is very much intact. And indeed, it's a very interesting story. Things that we maybe don't think about. You know, we sort of assume that the Chinese will just want to replicate the Western model. They're doing it quite differently, and that creates different opportunities. Local manufacturers, local brands, for example, doing very well. So I think that this unwillingness of investors, global investors, to really take Chinese stocks seriously is a great opportunity, actually.
Yeah, and I think you make a really good point there about the value part of this. Overall, over a very long term, it's the direction for the Chinese market has been a bit flat, but within that there's been big pockets where you could have invested, or you know you can obviously lose when you try and do this, but there have been big sort of trough to peak rises for China, and people shouldn't forget that when they buy into the Chinese story, because it is a great story. But I think many people have assumed, well, all I've got to do is park my money, see you in 20 years and I'll be rich. But actually valuations, all those fundamentals still really matter.
Yes. And I think the volatility is actually part of the problem because the Chinese market is so volatile. I think that the valuation multiples that investors are prepared to attach to Chinese shares are necessarily lower because they see that volatility as a risk. And of course, we know that volatility and risk are very different things. But if the market is going to bounce around, as it has in the last 2 years, for example, then that's going to scare off some overseas investors.
Now, there's a sort of other side to this story. We've actually hinted at it already, and that's the US. And China stumbling in terms of the stock market has been made to look worse, I suppose, by the gains being made in the US over a number of years now. A big part of that story has been tech. We had another US tech milestone in the past week, and that is the fact that Google, or its parent company Alphabet, has passed the $1 trillion valuation mark. I guess it's the growth of companies like Google that it helps explain why the US market has continued to soar, despite the fact that it is, you know, the most mature, the most developed, and you'd think for that reason the most slow-growing market, but it's just not proved to be the case.
Yes, and Alphabet is now the fourth US tech company to clear that hurdle, trillion-dollar hurdle. It's up there with Apple, of course, and Microsoft and Amazon, although I think Amazon is now actually just below a trillion. But no, the performance of those technology stocks has been the key driver, and it's very interesting actually, and it's one of the reasons why investing in the US is such a difficult thing for big professional investors to do, because the fact is that if you are not exposed to that relatively small number of companies, it's very difficult to beat the market, actually. And that's why active managers have tended to struggle, because active managers tend to be have a bias towards value stocks, cheaper stocks. And of course, they're not the stocks which have driven the US market
higher.
Yeah,
absolutely. Anyone holding an index fund in the US is going to have their top holdings being Google, Amazon, Microsoft. I don't think Facebook is far behind either. It's about half a trillion, but yeah. But on the list, it's fourth or fifth, I think. Now, it's interesting what you say there, that, you know, these companies have gone strength to strength, and the market seems to have, in one sense, sort of torn up the rule book about what companies of that size can do and how quickly they can grow. And in many ways, and I've written this week that Google, of all those, is the sort of purest example of that. If you look at Apple, if you look at Microsoft and Amazon, they all have one foot in the real world, if I can put it like that. Apple is a manufacturer of hardware, right? It makes millions and millions of iPhones. Amazon is a brilliant sort of online shop window, but it's also got this delivery sort of network logistics that help it work. Microsoft is sort of software and operating systems on a sort of, you know, commoditized base, you know, rolling it out. Google, it seems to me, is the one that is sort of genuinely creating its own markets. Advertising is where it makes its money, but as a sort of gatekeeper of all this data, almost like a curator of the internet, it's in a really unique position. I mean, you talk about moats and we talk about unassailable positions. Google seems to have that sewn up more than anyone else.
The interesting thing about Google, actually, is that what you described there of the strengths of the other companies, Google is actually involved, or actually not Google, but the other parts of Alphabet, and that's an important distinction,
yes,
is actually involved in all of those areas. I mean, it's involved in hardware through its Nest business. It's involved in the sort of software game through and the platform game through Google Play Apps business. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it has a cloud computing business competing with Amazon as well. But it is a relatively small part of Google. But I think that's the sort of black box, if you like, about Google, that the potential for those businesses, which is really unproven. No one knows whether any of these are going to be a big success for them.
Yeah.
But that's the optionality of Google, that actually if one of those comes off, then that's another string to its bow when it's already hugely successful, as you say, as a gatekeeper to the internet through things like YouTube, which is part of its dominant Google business. 84% of its revenues are come from Google, and about 16% from these other businesses that I've described. One of the interesting things about Google is there's no sort of transparency at all. No one, they're very careful about not giving anything away. I mean, even those other bets are all just lumped together into one reporting line. We know very little about what's going on beneath the bonnet at Google.
Yeah, and I've heard it said actually that maybe the biggest challenge for Google is finding the next market to break. It's got so much money to actually shift the dial on and make a difference to the business from a performance point of view. You've got to find some giant market. That's why it's looking at things like driverless cars and all these sort of slightly, you know, they can seem a bit harebrained, some of these things, but it's casting around for the thing that it can crack next with all this tremendous data it has.
Yeah, I mean, that's clearly what it's trying to do, and that is the challenge for investors, is deciding whether $1 trillion valuation is appropriate for that, because, you know, we simply don't know. And I've seen, you know, numbers bandied around and maybe twice that. Well, that may be true, but equally it could also be true that Google is worth a lot less than that. If you look at the valuation of Alphabet, it's currently trading on about a little over 30 times earnings. That puts it on a par with Microsoft, and it's actually a little bit more than Apple. So, you know, I would say that that kind of rating is quite punchy, but it's not excessive, actually. When you think about, you know, the growth potential of this company, you would expect to pay that sort of. So I don't think this is an unreasonable valuation for this company.
Yeah, and just finally on this, it strikes me that not that these companies will be tested for the first time when we get a recession, but the valuations on these companies will be tested for the first time. And I think it's during a recession, a global recession, you'll see exactly how they behave. I think there's an open question around, you know, is Apple, say, you know, a hardware company, or is it almost like a consumer staple? So Microsoft might be more a consumer staple because people always need it. You know, what's Google's ad revenue going to be like when there's global recession? Will it be actually quite a cyclical company? We just don't truly know that.
We don't, and the only thing we got is to look back to what happened in 2008, and the valuations of these tech companies did fall a lot. Yeah. I mean, they were certainly not remotely immune to what was going on in the broader economy, and that is of course exacerbated by high valuations, because investors inevitably will run for cover from the most highly valued companies when there's a downturn.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, well, Tom, that is it for now. That's all we have time for. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
You've been listening to the Money Talk podcast. Check fidelity.co.uk for daily written updates and articles on these and other topics from across Fidelity in the UK. And subscribe via iTunes to get the podcast downloaded direct to your devices every week. Please be aware that the value of investments and the income you get from them can go down as well as up, so you may not get back what you invest. This information doesn't constitute investment advice and should not be used as the basis for any investment decision, nor should it be treated as a recommendation for any investment. Eligibility to invest in an ISA or a pension and the value of tax savings depends on personal circumstances, and all tax rules may change. You will not normally be able to access money held in a pension until the age of 55. Reference to specific securities or funds should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell these securities or funds, and is included for the purpose of illustration only. Fidelity Personal Investing does not give personal recommendations. If you're unsure about the suitability of an investment, you should speak to an authorised financial advisor.